My name is Keith Heipel, and it's my pleasure then to chair the next session. We were delighted to hear the Minister Gary Lunn mention that technology is at least part, a big part of the solution. And are you going to hear some technological solutions now from my esteemed colleagues sitting to the right here? Let me mention that the people who will be presenting here are from the Canadian Academy of Engineering. For our American friends and people from overseas, we do have an organization at the federal level. It's called the Council of Canadian Academies. Under that council, which is an umbrella organization, we have the Royal Society of Canada, one of the sponsors of this conference, the Canadian Academy of Engineering, and also the Academy of Health Sciences. And this is a wonderful resource for the country, along with organizations like CG and our universities. These people who carry out these studies actually do them free of charge, and it's an opportunity for the governments of Canada, Ontario, and other provinces to get some really, hopefully, expert advice from some very renowned Canadians. The president of the Canadian Academy of Engineering, Ravi Ravindran, unfortunately was unable to make it today. They're having an international meeting in Tokyo right now of all the academies around the world. He did pass on his regards. He mentioned 2 points. His questions are, can Canada become a sustainable energy superpower? I think we heard that mentioned in the first session. The answer is yes, if you have good policy to implement a lot of these technological suggestions that will be made. And then the second question is, how do we balance sustainable energy supply with environmental concerns, social development, and economic realities? And I think that this wonderful conference is going to be addressing a lot of these ideas. Once again, he passes on his sincere congratulations to the organizers of the conference, John English, Jim Bosley, Bruce Mitchell, and many others who worked very hard. Let me introduce the speakers now and the members of the panel session as they present. It's my pleasure now to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Clem Bowman. You do have a curriculum vitae in the minutes, but let me just mention a few things about Clem. He was vice president of Esso Petroleum Canada in the past. He has extensive connections with industry. He was a president of the Alberta Research Council. He's a founding chairman of the Alberta Oil Sands Technology and Research Authority. He's been recognized for his work in Canada. He holds an Order of Canada. He's fellow of the Canadian Academy of Engineering. And as you'll see in a few minutes, over the last couple of years, he and many colleagues within the Canadian Academy of Engineering have written a wonderful report about energy. So I'll call now upon our first speaker, Dr. Clem Bowman.
Well, thank you very much, Keith. We have had a very interesting journey over the last 2 years on our Energy Pathways project. And really, it is about technology. At the start of this project, there were 2 challenges that we heard very clearly. The first challenge was that energy is Canada's last chance. That's pretty heady stuff. And we're thinking about the automotive industry. It's been a great Canadian success story, and we're clearly going to be a major player in the future. But to be recognized as the world leader is probably not a realistic expectation. And if you think about the forestry industry, we sure cut a lot of trees, but we don't even make chainsaws in Canada, to my knowledge. And with respect to value-added products, the pathway for most Canadians leads to the local IKEA store. And it may indeed be that energy is the only sector where Canada has an opportunity to achieve global leadership. The second challenge was that energy and the environment are on a collision course. And as a result, this is going to be the dominant issue facing our planet for this century. Well, if this is true, it's clear the environment's not going to step aside, and therefore we need to get energy onto some new pathways. What's the problem with our existing energy pathways? Let me show some examples. We cannot continue to burn coal as practiced now. The negative impact on the environment is too severe. We should not produce hydrogen from natural gas in the long term. Natural gas is one of our most desirable fossil fuels, and there are many other options for producing hydrogen. And we have to accept that society has or will put limits on the release of greenhouse gases. Canada is well behind Europe in bioenergy, and we are missing some highly desirable renewable energy options. Solar and wind are boxed in and cannot achieve their full potential until we're able to store intermittent energy sources. And the massive oil sands are hitting a wall, and solutions are needed for their extensive solutions for their extensive environmental impacts on water and air. I'm going to come back later and show how we can connect these dots up to solve some of these problems. Well, it's these issues that led to the initiation of the CAE Energy Pathway Project. The project is about barriers and technologies to overcome the barriers. It's not about policies or strategies. We are engineers and we build things, and we need to build new capacities in Canada to make us a sustainable, environmentally sound energy superpower. I'd like to pause to comment on Len Bolger. He was a co-initiator with me for our Energy Pathways project, and he was a strong believer that Canada has a unique opportunity for global energy leadership. And what I was not aware of until his death in February, that he'd been a test pilot for the Avro Arrow. He saw the Arrow program as a national project, which ended up as an opportunity lost, an opportunity based on knowledge and technology, not on natural resources. And colleagues, I think there's a message here. I'm going to be saying more about national projects, as I expect will my colleague, Dr. Marceau, the other half of our tag team today. Well, here's our summary of the Canadian energy system, including non-renewable sources, renewable sources, nuclear power, but the system is more than sources. We have hydrogen electricity, our important intermediate commodities, and carbon dioxide is a byproduct which must be dealt with. Well, here's the process we followed in carrying out our Pathways project. We formed a task force of 35. This represented our gray power. We selected 27 energy pathways. We developed 15 evaluation criteria. We selected more than 30 pathway proponents, and there were 65 self-appointed pathway evaluators. I'd like to refer briefly to the constructive tension which was generated in balancing the views of proponents and the evaluators. The ProGrid process was used as a method for achieving this balance without a single blow struck in anger. We thank the evaluators who served as realists. In this role, they represent those that keep our plants and factories running efficiently and safely. But I want to express my personal thanks to the proponents who, as an enthusiast, took the personal risk to firmly state their position and beliefs. Without the enthusiasts, we can forget about our sustainable vision of sustainable energy superpower. The 15-cell evaluation matrix was the engine which drove our evaluation process. Column A represents the assets that specific pathways bring to the table, including the scientific and commercial readiness and the fit to a socially acceptable national initiative. Column C represents the desired impact, including both economic and environmental targets. And column B provides the enablers that measure the Canadian capacity and fit. This form of evaluation matrix is the engine of ProGrid methodology. And here's the summary of the database that was generated in the evaluation process. Each pathway is plotted by its strength and pathway assets and expected impact. Now, the points on this chart represent the current position of specific pathways, and our diagnostic challenge arises in the analysis of what must be done to move the points to stronger grid positions. So that's the background. I'd now like to summarize our four recommendations. The first one is to initiate three national technology projects. The first is the gasification of fossil fuels, especially coal and biomass, to produce electricity, hydrogen, and carbon dioxide-rich streams. Gasification is a logical bridge to the hydrogen economy. Second, greenhouse gas emission control, including capture, transportation, storage, and use. And thirdly, is upgrades to electrical infrastructure, with emphasis here on a national grid and improved access by and storage of renewable energy sources. Recommendation two is to develop a network to carry out bioconversion demonstration projects. And this is a call for regional action to capture local opportunities. We have many feedstocks from agriculture, forestry, and various industrial waste, and we have many stakeholders. What do we need? We need a national network to organize and implement. And this can be spearheaded by a number of existing organizations in the bio area. Our recommendation three. This is the mission of capturing the huge energy opportunities available in Canada. We have highlighted 10 areas of opportunity, including wind and solar, gas hydrates, nuclear power for the oil sands, advanced fission reactors, geothermal, tidal, and wave. And this is not a job that should be left for government. In our view, existing R&D groups should drive the agenda by coordinating their programs and funding requests. And they should identify long-term goals and track progress. And this would be Canada's commitment to sustain our energy superpower vision. An energy superpower cannot ignore the potential huge impact of fusion energy in the long term. We cannot hope to lead in magnetic confinement in view of the massive ITER project underway in France, but we do have specific expertise that we can offer to the international program. Inertial confinement involving lasers is in a different position. Recent advances have changed the outlook, and there's an opportunity for a university-based contribution. And this should be defined and supported as our contribution to the international effort. Well, if Canada pursues these recommendations, we would have a very different perspective on the six problem areas which I showed in the earlier slide. And let's convert the problem into solutions. We would gasify, not burn coal. And hydrogen would come from water via coal or nuclear power. A management system would be in place to capture, store, and use carbon dioxide. Bioenergy would be demonstrated and available at many sites across the country. And solar and wind would be economically captured and stored. and various technology advances would be available for a new generation of oil sand processes with significantly reduced impact on air and water. If all four recommendations in our report are followed, we can visualize some different scenarios. And now energy comes about 75% from carbon-based sources, as shown in the now slide. It's not unreasonable to expect in the future that this can be reduced to 50%, with nuclear and renewables competing for their increasing share. Longer term, could see a continuing shift, perhaps led by the ultimate development of fusion power. But there'll always be a need for some carbon-based energy products, and our huge oil sands and natural gas deposits will meet any foreseeable future demands. Well, we think it's a time for action. Our first action should be immediately launch three national energy technology projects. What do we mean by a national technology project? It's a similar commitment or an impact, or it'll have impact similar to building our first cross-Canada railway and building the St. Lawrence Seaway. It's a bold step comparable to Premier Peter Lougheed's commitment in 1974 of $100 million seed money to support new technology for the deeply buried oil sands. At that time, the industry was stalled. Peter Lougheed's action quickly led to a $1 billion technology fund, which contributed in a major way to the oil sand industry that we have today. Starting a national technology project is not all that complex. First, it needs the upfront commitment of money. For example, $300 million in current dollars to follow Peter Lougheed's example. Without this, nothing happens. Once we get to this stage, champions will then emerge to lead and galvanize action. That's action. We also need new forms of private public sector collaboration, a new concept of risk-taking, embodied through an independent management board, which represents all stakeholders. All of these are well within the capability of our nation. We've done it before. Our second action is to formally launch our 100-year commitment to sustainable energy research. It should be a broad-based program, including bioenergy, many unconventional renewable and non-renewable sources, advanced fission reactors, and fusion energy. And once again, our various regional and national research organizations should step forward and develop interagency programs with clear commitments to long-range goals. And the progress needs to be measured and tracked. And that leads me to the last slide. Our superpower vision needs two things. It needs a signal and a brain. And let me explain. A crucial first step will be a signal of national will. And my suggestion here is an upfront commitment of $380 million as the signal. 380 is a magic number. It's the current value of the $100 million fund that Peter Lougheed established to awaken interest in the deeply buried tar sands. The next step would be to establish the brain. And this could range from a coalition of existing capabilities under a single overarching mission. This is the usual Canadian approach, but it's not my recommendation, since I believe it would blur responsibilities and remove accountability. I would prefer a single-person energy technology and research authority, which could then set objectives to allocate funding and to track progress. And this has to be done by stakeholders. They have to get behind it. I've called this the last slide, and I've been telling my colleagues it's my last slide also, because I'm coming up 78, and this has been a full-time two-year job for me, and I find there's a lot of young kids in their 50s and 60s out there that should be able to pick up and move this file forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Clem. You are indeed an inspiration. I thought I saw Minister Lund's head going like this in the audience, so maybe he likes the $380 million. We'll see at the lunch break. I should also mention we do have some information about the first technical study. The report's out in the far desk. Please help yourself. They are moving on to phase two, where they hope to link all this up to policy, and what a wonderful opportunity with the people who are here today. Our next speaker will be Richard Marceau. He's had a very good industrial background. He's with Hydro-Québec for quite a while. And among some of his other work, after getting his PhD, he was Dean of Engineering at Université de Sherbrooke. He's currently Provost of the University of Ontario Institute of Technology. And I understand another claim to fame is David Johnson actually handed him his PhD 15 years ago. Is that right? So let me now call upon Richard Marceau to give the next address.
Thank you very much, Keith. I'd like to say a few words on why I think we need national projects of the kind that Clem has just been talking about. Before I jump into that, I'd just like to say that I am not the Richard Marceau in the bio that you have in your book. Was once MP for Charlebourg for the Bloc Québécois. So I am not that Richard Marceau. I'm the other little boy from North Bay, that's why. Canadians have accomplished much in the last 140 years, ladies and gentlemen. We've taken a place little more than a wild frontier and have made it one of the most prosperous nations in the world. Unfortunately, this remarkable achievement is matched only by our extreme modesty or the very short memory that Canadians have of their successes. Few people, even among engineers, have knowledge of the extent to which great paradigm-shifting projects have defined who and what we are today. To bring us together as a nation, we have met staggering challenges. Through great projects, we have overcome physical distances between provinces and facilitated trade with the U.S. and elsewhere, overcome divisions between urban and rural areas, promoted Canadian unity through form or function, contributed to building a Canadian identity through icons and symbols, and built a remarkably prosperous and resilient modern economy. Let us reflect for a moment on the scale of some of these projects that have defined us. The Canadian Pacific Railway of the 1880s, which overcame overwhelming geographic and technological difficulties over thousands of kilometers more than a century and a quarter ago. The Victoria Bridge of the 1850s in Montreal, considered the eighth wonder of the world in its time. The Confederation Bridge of the 1990s, which unites PEI to New Brunswick. The Rideau Canal of the 1880s. The St. Lawrence Seaway of the 1950s. The Canadian Airport System, built originally as a Defense Department relief work project during the Depression era of the 1930s. The Trans-Canada Highway, thousands and thousands of kilometers, built from the 1940s to the 1970s. The Trans-Canada Microwave Network of the 1950s, supporting both long-distance telephone service and national TV. Pioneer commercial satellites in the 1960s and 70s. The CANDU program of the 1940s, which led to today's impressive Canadian nuclear generation industry, one of the world's oldest and most reliable, I must underline. The Athabasca tar sands development, the petroleum and gas pipelines which connect Alberta and Ontario and Quebec over thousands of kilometers again, the Hibernia oil field, Sarnia's huge petrochemical industry. This is a $6 billion a year town with only 78,000 people who live in it. The world's largest automotive complex. Do you know where it is? It's in Oshawa. And numerous hydroelectric power projects such as Niagara Falls, 2 gigawatts built in the 1920s and 30s. Beauharnois in Montreal, 1.5 gigawatts, built in the 30s to the 50s. The James Bay Complex, 15 gigawatts from the 1950s to the 1970s. Churchill Falls, 5 gigawatts, again from the 50s to the 70s. The Nelson River Complex in Manitoba. Long distance AC, DC, EHV transmission. The CN Tower, the Calgary Tower, even Expo 67. And there are many, many others. These and all those other projects have contributed to creating Canada as we know in numerous and complex ways. But what if we hadn't done them? What if, for instance, Canadians in the 1880s had accepted conventional wisdom that a transcontinental railway was too expensive, too risky? How long would it have been before Canada would simply have been just another part of the U.S.? Or most of it? Consider Ontario. If there hadn't been a homegrown nuclear technology available in the 1950s, would Ontario Hydro have made the decision to opt for nuclear power generation and build a demonstration plant at Rolleston in 1962? Well, I would suggest that the answer is probably not. Now, let's pursue that train of thought. What if Ontario Hydro had not made that decision in the 1950s? Would it have done so in the 70s, based on U.S. technology, while opposition to nuclear was beginning to swell? Well, I would suggest, again, probably not. And if this was the case, would nuclear power, which now represents 50% of the province's generating capacity, have been compensated by fossil fuel generation? And again, because of opposition to coal in the 70s and 80s, well, the answer is probably not. Which begs the question, would Ontario's economy be what it is today? And the answer, I believe, is most likely not. If C.D. Howe had not built the Canadian airport infrastructure in the 1930s, or the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 1950s, how easily could we travel between provinces today? And how much less trade would we have with the rest of the world? If we were deprived of our communication system and the underlying expertise which we presently take absolutely for granted, where would our economy be today? If some courageous researchers and entrepreneurs 50 and 60 years ago had not begun developing the extraction technology, which we now take for granted in the Athabasca tar sands, how economically strong would Canada be today? I mean, really today. In other words, take any of the projects that I have named so far. Without them, we would have a smaller Canada, a weaker Canada, a poorer Canada. Now, great projects are not without detractors. For decades, well-meaning public figures have criticized nuclear power and even hydroelectric power for their various environmental impacts. Only recently have we seen a shift in public attitudes. And the same is true of the tar sands. Despite their huge economic impact, national in scope, they are viewed by some as a major environmental liability. But what if we made solving key tar sands processing issues a truly national project? What if, as Canadians, we solve these problems ourselves with the objective of building a stronger and wealthier Canada? I believe that we must not miss the opportunities we have to do the right thing. The price of missed opportunity is very, very high. A case in point is the Avro Arrow, cancelled at the end of the 1950s. Even today, people grieve the tremendous loss this represented to the Canadian aerospace and the electronics industries. Despite Canada's newfound strength in the world aerospace industry today, let us not forget that it has taken half a century for us to reclaim what had been ours to lose in the first place. Clem Bowman and I are here today on behalf of the Canadian Academy of Engineering because we believe, as does the Academy, that the three national projects presented here today will unleash enormous economic potential and create incredible competitive advantages for Canadian industry across the continent. I would suggest that as Canadians, that we remember our past and do as before. Build the great projects that will reinvent our country, its future, and continue to provide unparalleled opportunity to our children. Thank you for your kind attention.
Merci bien, Richard. The final speaker is Ian Rollins. We wanted somebody from outside of the Canadian Academy of Engineering who's an energy expert but did not partake in the development of this massive study to actually read the report, perhaps give some comments to get the discussion going right after this. Let me just briefly mention that Ian is an associate professor and he's also associate dean for research in the Faculty of Environmental Studies at the University of Waterloo. Another claim to fame, as part of its 50th anniversary celebration, the university had an energy week, or energy days, and Ian was the main driving force behind that. We had some very nice seminars this week, including one here on Tuesday evening. Ian.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you very much to the organizers for the opportunity to participate on the panel today. And in particular, thank you to Drs. Bowman and Marceau for the summaries of the fascinating work of the Canadian Academy of Engineering. The Academy is to be congratulated on its initiative. The Energy Pathways Task Force is tackling a critical set of issues for this country. As was presented in the summary today, and indeed in the first panel we had, the future of our energy system is critical to our well-being. And we should be grateful to the Academy for the efforts they have exerted in bringing together more than 100 energy experts to reflect upon these issues. Given the wealth of information presented here in the report, there's obviously a number of issues that people may want to react to. The recommendations from the Pathways report have been laid out very articulately by the first two speakers, and the Academy is calling for significant investment in particular strategies. So it's certainly the case that the menu of options being laid out right now may want to be reflected upon by some in the audience and certainly scrutinized more carefully. Indeed, some may want to call for some additional things, elements to be added to this menu of options. And it was noted that there are a number of different pathways identified, and indeed, as I gather from reading the report, not everyone was able to be investigated into the depth desired. So it may be revisiting some of those possibilities in order to broaden the menu of possibilities. And I guess I would be interested in seeing energy efficiency, which is talked about in conjunction with a number of the pathways, perhaps given its own particular focus as well. We've heard during the comments in the first session this morning already of the possibility of reflecting more upon energy efficiency. And indeed, many in this room have probably heard the term megawatt rather than megawatt for years or perhaps even decades. I have just one figure up there on the slide suggesting that Canada's level of energy efficiency amongst OECD countries is not particularly high. We rank 29th of 30th on that particular measure, and indeed it is Iceland that is below us. Yes, it's the case that we're a country that has traditionally had low energy prices, a wonderful resource endowment, which has been mentioned, as well as a cold climate. So those conditions help to explain the particular ranking, but it remains the case that perhaps there are opportunities there for pursuing. Nevertheless, what I'd like to focus upon in my brief remarks are two issues that are related to the evaluation of the different energy pathways laid out in the report. First, I'm always interested in goals and the ways in which we measure our progress towards those goals. Recently in the discourse here in Canada, and I gather some other countries as well, there's been talk about becoming an energy superpower. In the words of the Prime Minister, a clean energy superpower. Terms like these, however, often mean different things to different people. And it's often valuable and indeed critical to think about how different elements are prioritized behind that catchphrase, and perhaps how trade-offs are made if they have to be made as well. To its credit, and already seen this slide up today, the Energy Pathways report lays bare its priorities very, very transparently. It's aiming to make Canada a sustainable energy superpower, and more specifically, it identifies 15 entries in its evaluation matrix. And the entries cover a wide range of themes: environmental issues, social issues, economic issues. It is interesting to reflect upon these criteria and contrast them with other evaluation criteria we see out there. There are a number of eco-labels for energy that exist in countries around the world. The couple of slides I have up are from the Canada's National Eco-Label Program for low-impact renewable electricity, and the other one from our neighbors from the south, the Green E Program in the United States. There has been thinking there about what is part of a desirable electricity system as part of a broader energy system. Environmental groups have put together ideas. In the United States, the Power Scorecard has been developed in order to suggest where should we be going with regard to our electricity system. There's also been the application of broader sustainability principles brought to bear upon particular energy questions. Here in this province, the Ontario Power Authority, as it reflects upon how things may develop over the next 30 years, have used our colleague Bob Gibson's work on sustainability principles, thinking about how that can help to guide the planning of the power system over the coming years. It would certainly be instructive to investigate how the Academy's very interesting and comprehensive 15 elements compare and contrast with these different sets of criteria. I'm intrigued by Gibson's argument that we must pay attention to precaution and adaptation. In some of his words, we must plan to learn, design for surprise, and manage for adaptation. It might be interesting to see how those ideas brought to bear upon the pathways would enrich that discussion and investigation. A second area related to the evaluation of the pathways that I'd like to flag relates to the ways in which the pathways may be situation dependent. While it's acknowledged in the report that there are interconnections amongst the different pathways, each of the pathways is identified, investigated, primarily in an individual manner. You saw the grid up there from one of the earlier slides where the different pathways were plotted on the grid. By contrast, however, a number of people are suggesting the evaluation of the individual technology is important, but it may be context-dependent as well. While the quality of the technology, its performance, can and should be reflected upon, it still matters where that technology is situated and where it operates. To give one example, and my example here, the unpleasant things belching out of the factory there, are not the greenhouse gases. They are unpleasant, but we probably all know in this room that location of greenhouse gas emissions may not be as important as, if you look closely, you will squint and see those are smog precursors, and the location of the smog precursors from the particular power plant, where they are emitted is consequential. If the power plant is located upwind of a barren area, that has one set of consequences. If it's located upwind of a large town or a city, that has another set of consequences. The Pathways report encourages us and demands that we look at the major environmental impacts, categorizing greenhouse gases as a particular element. Other environmental impacts is also very important, and I would echo that. It just might be interesting to reflect upon the location of the different, the way that, where the pathways unfold. That is to suggest that location matters. That is where the pathway is unfolding and where the so-called receptors are located. I guess I'm also interested in the fact that it not only matters the location in the sense of the built environment, in the sense of human populations, but also in the sense of the social institutions in which the pathway is operating. And as another example, let me consider solar energy for electricity or photovoltaics. And this is a pathway given a study in the report, and a very interesting study. As with many of the 20-some-odd pathways, there's investigation of the opportunity grid and also a detail of the opportunity profile where the relative strengths and weaknesses are laid out. But in some work that we've completed, we've tried to argue that it's also important to look at the particular market in which a solar technology is located, to understand in this instance the economic value, also the environmental value of that particular technology. Here in Ontario, there's a fairly close correlation between solar electricity potential and Ontario electricity market demand. And on the graph there, I have from a typical day in the summer, Wednesday, 8th of August, 2007. The blue figures are from the radiation, the weather station at the University of Waterloo, suggesting the intensity of solar radiation. Not surprisingly, it rises in the morning, peaks at midday, and falls in the afternoon. And the red figures are system-wide demand in the Ontario market. They broadly follow the same shape, though admittedly the air conditioning demand in this province is skewed a bit towards the later afternoon, and that's where the demand is pushed up. When you consider prices instead of demand, you will see also that demand, that prices in the Ontario electricity market follow solar electricity to some extent. Again, it's a bit later in the afternoon where that demand peaks. I guess my point is simply the case that it's important to recognize that Ontario is a summer peaking electricity system, and that means that solar has particular potential in this jurisdiction. It may be able to play a particularly valuable role in peak shaving, which has economic benefits as well as environmental benefits. The story, however, may be different in other jurisdictions, and I just have some figures there to reveal the fact that a summer peaking electricity system in Canada is relatively unique to Ontario. Our friends in Quebec, our friends in British Columbia have different kinds of electricity system. Much less use of residential air conditioning, greater use of electric heating, and therefore often a winter peaking system rather than a summer peaking system. You probably know enough the legends about Canadian winters if you're not from here. Solar radiation is weaker in the winter than it is in the summer. So the potential for solar to play a role in those parts of the country may be reduced, may take on a different kind of position in the energy portfolio. But in conclusion, let me reiterate my appreciation to the Canadian Academy of Engineering for their stimulating contributions to this critical debate. As we all reflect upon these issues, a summary of some of the questions that came to my mind as I read the very interesting reports, I've just laid them out here. The options for moving, the technical options in particular, for moving Canada's energy agenda forward. What do we want? What's our preferred future? And how do we measure and evaluate the alternatives? And what are the next steps? A very sincere plea from the presenters was a demand for action and moving forward, so certainly a reflection on that as well. The status quo is not acceptable, and that's been revealed by a number of the presentations already. The environment won't wait, and therefore we must move to action on the energy file. And thank you for the report for helping us do that. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Ian, for your thoughtful comments. We'd now like to open up the session here for questions from the floor. And I believe you do have a person with a microphone. If you wouldn't mind identifying yourself when you do ask a question.
Hello? Robert LaFrance, Bank of Canada. I obviously am an economist, not an engineer. But from the presentation, Mr. Bauman, I got the idea that you guys think big. And I was wondering to what extent because one of the presenters at the previous panel talked about the transportation of energy, How does centralized big plants producing electricity across the country versus generation in smaller units, solar panels, wind vanes, whatever, in local areas, how does that compare going forward? And I guess my second question, maybe to the panel, or perhaps Mr. Rowland is more aware of this, I'd like to get an idea if these plans come to fruition, how do they mesh with, say, the goals that Canada set for itself in terms of reduction of gases?
Thank you. Would you like to respond, Clem or Richard?
You want to handle the one on the large mix? And the,
I guess one theme we had in the Academy study, the project, was to provide technology options rather than saying what the targets, for instance, greenhouse gas targets should be, was to make sure we had the technology capability to meet whatever demands there were on it. My colleague, I'm going to ask my colleague to answer the first question on the mix between large and small generations and how that interfaces with the electrical grid, because we think this is the huge challenge on our third national project, and we've got all kinds of people who have very interesting concepts and ideas on that.
Thank you, Clem. I don't think that we're talking about an either-or situation here between large and small. I think we're talking about an and-or situation. I think that if you look at the way we need energy in Canada generally, whether it's whether it's at the home or elsewhere, when you can install a lot of solar and you can have windmills all over the place. The problem with solar and windmills is that they're not always there when you need them to. You invest a lot of money in capacity, but the capacity isn't producing when you might need it and not necessarily where you might need it. And it's equally true at the local individual level, the home level, and it's also true at the system level. So one of the things that we have been thinking about and that we have integrated into our Pathways report is how do you take renewables and make them available to someone when the renewables are actually producing something for their, you're getting return on your investment. And the answer is you need a means of wheeling power around the country, if you're talking about electricity, where when you've got production capacity that's actually being used, you can connect it to somebody who actually has a need for it at that moment in time. So that explains the national grid project to a certain degree. The management of renewables is a difficult thing when you're doing it locally. Renewables, as I said, don't necessarily produce the electricity that you'd like them to when you might need it. So renewables, whether you're at the home level or the system level, require you to have storage capacity. At the home level, you might have storage capacity in a battery of some kind, whether it's old battery technology or new battery technology, but you can store that energy in a battery and extract the energy from your battery when you need it, if the local generation capacity isn't being used. However, at the system level, you can use a lot of potential synergies between the different renewables and their particular character. Let me give you an example. Suppose you have a gigawatt of solar and wind connected in a local utility in a province, for instance. If that province doesn't have hydroelectric power connected to it, well, it's very difficult to use that one gigawatt and store it somewhere if it's producing when you don't particularly need it. So if you've got hydro in the mix, either to pump water into a reservoir at night or when that particular asset is generating electricity, that's one way of storing energy. Another way of storing energy from renewables that aren't always there when you need them is by reducing the hydroelectric generation where you do have reservoirs and you don't need to draw upon that. So hydro installations are a tremendous way of either conserving stored energy in the form of water in reservoirs or by creating new reservoirs. And it's applying at the system level what you would do at the home level anyway. I think I'll stop there. It's a huge issue, but it's the other issue is that one could touch upon is the idea of time zones. You don't peak at the same time in Ontario as you would in Alberta. So if you have a huge energy pipeline that connects Vancouver to Labrador, you have means of wheeling either renewables or hydro or peaking capacity from thermal or nuclear anywhere across the nation if you've got a big enough pipeline, and we can build it today. The last point that I would make about that pipeline is that there is an integration of energy markets which is truly happening today in a way that we've been talking about for at least a quarter of a century, but which is really happening today. Natural gas is becoming a global commodity as opposed to a local commodity as it has been for a long time. So that's one example. If you don't have a pipeline that goes somewhere, but you can instantaneously wheel energy from a fossil fuel source that you're using locally to peak, to help somebody peak 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 kilometers away. This is high-value added peaking capacity that you don't need to build and you don't need to waste assets on. I'll stop there.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? This gentleman over here.
My name is David McGinnis with the Canadian Energy Pipeline Association. Congratulations to the Academy for the study. It's an incredibly important piece. Clem, you mentioned Lougheed's vision years ago, and Richard had an impressive list of nation-building projects. I would suggest that most of those, while ultimately they were nation-building, came out of a desire for a particular government, indeed political party, to drive votes in a particular region. How do you get past that? How do you get governments to work together in the context that the provinces own the resource? Obviously, I'm especially talking about fossil fuels. And how do you get the feds and provinces to work together on the policy approach that would see some of your recommendations come to life?
I wish we knew the answer to that. I just make a comment on Lougheed in 1974. The issue he was facing was not votes. He had plenty of votes. The issue he was facing is that the companies had walked away from the deeply buried oil sands through a number of factors. I won't go into all the history of that, but they actually shut down all field work on the deeply buried oil sands. And so he had to do something. His vision was to get a field demonstration project going in each of the four different oil sand deposits. That was a very simple objective. He set that up and said, well, how do I start that? He did not say, I have some money. You bring a project into me. He said, here's my $100 million to industry. He said, you match it. And here's what I want you to do. And one company matched the full 100. And then what did Peter Lougheed do then? He put another 100 on the table. And then it moved up to eventually the total of $1 billion. So it took the vision of a need. So I think somehow we've got to articulate the nation wants to do these things. It wants to put a railway across Canada. It wants to have electrical grid that connects the whole regions of Canada that we can put all kinds of power into. I thought that the Prime Minister, when he made the statement that Canada is an energy superpower, was searching for that kind of vision, and we're clearly not an energy superpower now. I think Annette is working on that subject. But we could be, and that's the point. It's a matter of getting the vision accepted. And when we're dealing with the issues that cross the provinces and it crosses ownership issues, they're huge. But as a nation, we've done it before. We've done it in wartime, and we don't want to have a war to do it. But we can, I think, if we could just get a few goals set out there and say we are going to commit to it we have the silos in Canada. The first thing is to break those down. So I think the governments can help set the vision and the mission, but I think the private sector has to help, too, by saying, okay, here are goals we can help achieve. And in the case of the oil sands, the $100 million was really just a minor little thing in this, but that was enough of a symbol that they said, well, this government wants something to happen in the oil sands.
Okay, I think we have a question. A gentleman here and then a lady in behind the cameraman. Just over here, this table here. Yeah.
Hello, my name is Stephen Clarkson from the University of Toronto. I work on North American governance, and I was intrigued by the notion of Monsieur Marceau just expressed about a trans-Canada energy electricity grid. But so my question is, to what extent does the north-south integration of many of our energy systems make any kind of national dream now impossible?
I would argue, once again, that it's not an either-or, it's an and-or. There's we have exploited the opportunities that are north-south for many decades now, and arguably for more than a century. What we're really talking about is, in addition to exploiting those opportunities, there are other opportunities to explore that are east-west as opposed to north-south. Whether it's energy, whether it's intelligentsia, whether it's manufactured goods, the relationships between, whether it's culture or the arts, north-south is a lot stronger than east-west in Canada. And one of the, I think the Clem has said it very clearly, what is our vision for Canada going forward? Who are we? What are we going to do? What are the things that we're going to do to bring us together? And what are the opportunities that we can seize in doing so? If, for instance, you have a project that unites Canadians, not just in the way that it's going to be done, not just in the process of doing it, but in the outcomes that particular project will result in, that project will reinforce Canada as a whole, east-west, but it will also enable, I would argue, accelerate north-south trade. I'll give you one example. Presently there is no electric energy superhighway between the east and the west. We do have a lot of interconnections between north and south, everywhere. Suppose New England wanted to wheel power 3 hours later to California, which basically needs it very dearly right now. Well, there is no superhighway, and they're not interconnected. So if we Canadians built one, we would sell them the right of way and cash in on a lucrative market of wheeling power from east to west. It can be American power. It can be Canadian power. It's power, and it's a market opportunity. It's just, what is our vision of what this country is going to be 25, 30, 50, 100 years from now? And what are the things that we can do to reinforce things? I'll give you an example. I find sometimes that the Ottawa River is larger than the Atlantic Ocean. What are we going to do to bring that a little less wide, if I can put it that way? There's a divide there, and we ought to be working on it. Okay, thank you. I guess we had one lady and then Jatin. We'll have to make those the last two questions before we briefly sum up.
Hi, I'm Beatrice Orchard, University of Waterloo. And I noticed that there was a great enthusiasm for engineering projects. And I found what was missing from them was the understanding of the political mechanisms whereby these things came about, particularly associated with the trans...
Can you hold the microphone closer to your...
Is that better?
That's better. Yes. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Thank you.
What I wanted to make the point of is that there was a great presentation and consideration of what energy projects or engineering projects have done for this country to build it, to develop it. But what I found was a little bit of a blankness, if you will, when it came to the political tensions, political problems that had been created and generated in tandem with these projects. And since we have changed a great deal in how politics is done in this country, have we thought about, when it comes to building these projects which you envision, how we're going to accomplish them politically, how we will change that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wonder if, would you like to respond to that?
As one who is not participating in the report's development but have read it, my thought is the points you're getting at, there is an element of societal impacts in the evaluation matrix. So an opportunity, I'm guessing, for the evaluators to bring in some of their initial ideas with regard to that. That having been said, I very much agree with your comments that the way in which these projects or proposals are received, perhaps more ideally, the way in which they were developed by the community writ large, would be particularly influential in the prospects for their success. And I think your comments hint at sort of the policy aspects as well, which is, I think, something we'll be turning to explicitly after lunch as well. But others may want to come in.
Yeah, and I could just add that the Canadian Academy of Engineering is well aware of this, and this was indeed their next step. That's the train's ready to leave the station. Let's get it moving. And, of course, you need policy, and it has to mix in with the politics properly. And what a wonderful opportunity here at CG to look at these wonderful connections. Final question then from Chitin.
Thank you, Jatin Nathwani, University of Waterloo. I wanted to amplify the point around this national grid that you've discussed. Certainly we are interconnected. Certainly the desire is to enhance, let's say, electricity trade through arbitrage on the market and so on, and more of that could be done. The angle that perhaps we need to focus on here is if you look at Canada and drew a line, it's kind of green power. Canada's map would look green in the sense that it's hydro in Quebec, Newfoundland, Labrador, Manitoba, Ontario, again green from a carbon standpoint, nuclear and so on. And if you look at the United States and its mix, not that green. And so therefore, not only from a trade perspective, but the ability to look ahead and see what happens to carbon atoms and the ability to do both peaking arbitrage from Newfoundland power, for example, to the notion that it is actually green power from Canada. That's another lens through which we could look at it. That's
all. Who'd like to respond briefly?
I'd like to respond by not talking about the grid. I'll give you an example of opportunity that these national projects would provide that have nothing to do with the projects themselves to some degree. And one of those is carbon sequestration, capture and sequestration. Greenhouse gases, especially CO2, found in the air, are what create trees and plant life and potatoes and tomatoes and everything that we see that is green and the things that we eat. That comes from the air. It doesn't come from the ground. The trees, carbon, extracts the carbon from the air. Gets water and minerals from the ground. So if you have all of this CO2 that's been captured somewhere, what I think there is a great deal of research, and there's a tremendous opportunity for Canadians to do this research, to see how we can accelerate plant growth, vegetation growth, in controlled atmospheres with high CO2 atmospheres. There is very little that's been done on this. If we have massive quantities of CO2 available to us, how can we grow food faster? How can we do it better? Is there something that we can do with this gas that we find is an inconvenience if it's in the atmosphere, but it could be as valuable as natural gas to produce food as natural gas is to do the kinds of things that it does so well in industry, such as chemical transformation, manufacturing of plastics, and so on. So there is an opportunity to take something and put it on its head and see a disadvantage, or not just a challenge, maybe a tremendous liability, and transform it into a tremendous opportunity. And if we could think about this and talk about it and communicate this vision, not just to ourselves, who are academics and maybe engaged stakeholders from industry, but to talk about it to politicians, to people who are in the public service. These people want to do the right thing. If we communicate to them a vision that they can buy because they feel it's the right thing to do for themselves, for their children, for their grandchildren, well, they'll do it for everybody.
Okay, I think we should just give the opportunity to the panelists to briefly sum up, if you'd like to say a few words in conclusion. Clem?
Well, I'll just pick up the comment that there's been a few things that have been identified that Ian brought up that we need to do. The Academy report's called Phase 1. And the reason it's called phase one is that we've just started the journey. And there's a lot to do, and we know the deficiencies. We did our best, and I think the concept of maybe linking some of the evaluation methods that people are using to make decisions with what we have done with the Academy, Ian, I think is a very useful idea. So we welcome help, and I think there's some shared things we can sort of work on. So anybody that wants to team up with us on phase two, the door is open. Thank you.
Any other final comments?
I'd just like to say that I'd like to thank you for listening to us this morning. Clem and I and the Academy really believe that there is an opportunity here to transform the face of Canada, to take a tremendous challenge, which is the tar sands, for instance, and transform it into a fantastic opportunity if we work as Canadians to do it ourselves and to do it for Canada and for our children and grandchildren. Thank you very much.
Just a quick announcement before I formally thank all our panelists. If you wouldn't mind, please go exiting through the doors into the far lobby for about 15 minutes. They have to set up for the luncheon. Also, for those who'd like washroom facilities, they're on the second floor beyond the second set of doors. And let me just, in closing, we'd like to thank CG for this opportunity to present the Academy's viewpoint here today. And I'd especially like to thank our three speakers. Well done.